Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and perhaps if you'd like to take your seats, we ought to get going. My name is Denis Galligan, Professor of Sociolegal Studies here in the University of Oxford, and a member of the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society. And so I'd like to welcome you all to this lecture this evening, which is the first part in a two-day workshop on the subject of the social contract, and in particular under the title Equality and Personal Responsibility in the New Social Contract. This is part of a wider program that the Foundation has been conducting into the nature of the social contract in the 21st century. Workshops have been dedicated to such subjects as employment, taxation, and others of that kind. This workshop that we're about to start is meant to be an opportunity to stand back from those more practical, applied subjects and look at a more theoretical, more abstract feature of the framework within which a social contract might be envisaged. So it promises to be an extremely important lecture and workshop. And I just want to say the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society is an independent institute affiliated with the university through the Centre for Sociolegal Studies. Its purpose is to raise issues about the role of law, particularly in society, but of course once you start looking at the role of law, you immediately have to look at a whole lot of other things, such as the political and economic and social arrangements. The Foundation is very much committed to making this academic-style research more available to a wider audience outside the academy. And so one of our objectives is to try to make that research, which is often read only by other academics, to make that a little more available outside through our publications, our website, and so on. Well, against that background, it's now my pleasure to welcome Professor John Romer, Stout Professor of Political Science at Yale University, well known in the field, previously of the economics faculty at UCLA, University of California, Davis. He's a graduate of Harvard and Berkeley, and well known for his research in the area of equal opportunities. A very long list of publications. I just mentioned two recent books, which many of you will know, Equality of Opportunity and Democracy, Education and Equality. Professor Romer, we're very pleased to welcome you here. Professor Romer will speak for roughly 50 minutes and then has agreed that at the end of that we will have 20, 25 minutes for discussion and questions. So, Professor Romer, over to you.
Thank you, Denis. I'd like to dedicate this presentation to the memory of Brian Barry. The name of the conference, Equality and Responsibility in the Social Contract, suggests two possible topics that I might address. The first is how responsibility entered into egalitarian theory in the last 40 years, which was chiefly through the writings of John Rawls and Ronald Dworkin, who both relied deeply on contractarian arguments to advance their claims of what justice or equality consists in. The second topic is less high-minded. It's how we can justify egalitarian policy measures, more generally, what degree of equality we can justify as a goal of social policy, given our actually existing social contracts in contemporary advanced democracies. I will attempt to address both of these topics. It may surprise you that I will argue that contractarian arguments of both Rawls and Dworkin fail to justify the kind of equality they advocated. Indeed, the original position of Rawls and the hypothetical insurance market of Dworkin, which is his contractarian venue, both produce results that are undesirably unequal if they are correctly modeled. This might seem to present a crisis for egalitarian theory, as so much of our present theory apparently relies on the work of Rawls and Dworkin. The crisis is the following. If we find either Rawls's or Dworkin's original positions or hypothetical insurance market an attractive thought experiment, then must we not live with the inegalitarian recommendations that I claim they produce. I will argue that we need not, because of one of their central premises, that individuals or those denizens who represent them behind the veil of ignorance are entirely self-interested. It is this assumption, I claim, which must be jettisoned and replaced with a conception of solidarity. It's a dangerous undertaking to attempt to summarize Rawls's argument in a few pages or minutes. There will be numerous objections that the various subtle qualifications which he gives throughout Theory of Justice have been ignored. Nevertheless, I think it's necessary to do so. Sorry? Some may object that I am forcing Rawls's complex thought into the economist's Procrustean bed. I make no attempt to deal here with the entire Rawlsian edifice, but only with the theory of economic distribution and how it's argued for. For Rawls, people have life plans, which in economic theory would be called preferences. All life plans need certain inputs, which Rawls calls primary goods, and Rawls assumes that an index of primary goods can be created, which can be used to aggregate any bundle of primary goods into a single number, that is, by placing certain weights on each good. Once we have such an index, we can say that one bundle of primary goods, X, is greater than another bundle, Y, when the weighted sum of goods in X is greater than the weighted sum of goods in Y, using this indexing system. The important assumption here is that every life plan is enhanced by having a greater amount of the primary goods so indexed. It's a heroic assumption that such an index can be constructed, but I don't want to dwell on this point here. Indeed, if such an index exists, then an economist would say that every person's life plan preferences can be represented by a utility function that is just the indexed sum of the primary goods that he consumes or enjoys. Rawls views the many circumstances of a person's situation as morally arbitrary. It's a matter of luck what the birth lottery gives you in the way of the family to which you are assigned, the talents and handicaps that you will have, and the income-generating capacity that these circumstances will eventually engender. In the original position, there is a soul who represents each person, and these souls are to agree on a distributive rule for the primary goods. They don't know the plans of life of the persons whom they represent, but they do know that every person wants more primary goods rather than fewer, as aggregated by the index. Not only do they not know the life plans of their person, but they do not know the distribution of life plans in the actual world. The souls in the original position are assumed to be interested only in the primary goods their principals receive. They are self-interested. The veil of ignorance which filters out these facts about the world is constructed in order to shield the souls from knowledge of facts which Rawls views as morally arbitrary events. The morally arbitrary events in question are the actual circumstances and endowments of individual persons. But why shield souls from knowledge of the life plans of their persons? Rawls never argues that a person's life plan is morally arbitrary. In particular, his view is quite the opposite, that persons are responsible for their plans of life. He writes in 1982, "The third respect in which citizens are regarded as free is that they are regarded as capable of taking responsibility for their ends, and this affects how their various claims are assessed. Citizens are thought capable of adjusting their aims and aspirations in the light of what they can reasonably expect to provide for," end of quote. But if persons are responsible for their ends, which I take to be their life plans, why should they not know these life plans in the original position? After all, the original position is meant to obscure knowledge of only morally arbitrary features of persons. And why should they not know, in addition, the distribution of life plans among the whole society? Is this not a fact about the world, a fact that is surely not morally arbitrary? Rawls has, in fact, constructed the original position so that all souls are identical. They each know only that they wish to maximize the index of primary goods of their person, and they know nothing about probabilities or preferences. So what goes on behind the veil of ignorance cannot be described as a contract. It's, in fact, a decision problem of a single agent. In fact, Rawls recognizes this. He writes, "It's clear that since the differences among the parties are unknown to them, and everyone is equally rational and similarly situated, each is convinced by the same arguments. Therefore, we can view the agreement in the original position from the standpoint of one person selected at random. The agent, this agent, simply wants to maximize the primary goods going to his person. I must emphasize there is no altruism. Rawls assumes that each soul represents only the interests of his person." Not knowing any probabilities or even preferences over risk that their persons have, there is really no accepted way of solving this decision problem. The veil of ignorance is just too thick to use classical decision theory. Nevertheless, Rawls gives three arguments for why the soul will choose the difference principle, that is, the distributive rule that chooses the distribution of primary goods, which awards the largest index to the person who receives the smallest such index, hence the terminology of maximin. The obvious way to justify this choice is that the soul is hyper-risk averse. It's possible that the person whom it represents will be a member of that worst-off class, and hence a hyper-risk-averse soul would choose to make that class as well-off as possible. Although Rawls equivocates and sometimes claims that he is not relying on hyper-risk aversion, it's very clear that indeed he is. He writes that choosing the maximin distribution would not generally be a good choice when facing risk, but there are three features of the original position which make it so. The first feature is that the probabilities of having various life plans and circumstances are unknown. So there are no probability computations one can make. Well, this begs the question. As I've said, the probabilities should be known behind the veil of ignorance, for they are facts about the world. They're not morally arbitrary. The second feature is that, quote, "the person choosing has a conception of the good such that he cares very little, if anything, for what he might gain above the minimum stipend that he can, in fact, be sure of by following the maximin rule. It is not worthwhile for him to take a chance for the sake of a further advantage, especially when it may turn out that he loses much that is important to him." Well, this is purely and simple a statement of extreme risk aversion. Is this a general description of human psychology? Surely not. The third feature is, quote, "that the rejected alternatives, i.e. non-maximin distributions, have outcomes that one could hardly accept. The situation involves grave risks," end of quote. But this, too, is simply a statement of extreme risk aversion. Why can one hardly accept an alternative to maximin? Only because one is extremely risk averse and pays attention only to the event that one ends up in the worst off class. Some political philosophers respond to these criticisms of Rawls's original position formulation by saying that, after all, the construction was not really important for his view, that it was just an example of how the view might be justified. I find this an incredible claim. Rawls's formulation that his theory is justice as fairness relies entirely on the original position. Rawlsian justice is an instance of fairness precisely because it is a contractarian outcome in an original position which shields persons from knowledge of morally arbitrary facts. He writes, "The original position is the appropriate initial status quo, and thus the fundamental agreements reached in it are fair. This explains the propriety of the name justice as fairness." If one excises the original position from the theory of justice, one loses as well the claim that justice is fairness. If one accepts these criticisms, then a natural move would be to reconstruct the original position, endowing the souls with knowledge of the life plans of their persons, of the distribution of life plans in the society, and of the distribution of circumstances, although not the knowledge of their own person's circumstances, which are morally arbitrary, the circumstances. This is essentially the construction that John Harsanyi made in 1953, and he thought that he had deduced that the social contract following from it would be utilitarian. That is, that it would distribute wealth and other resources to maximize total welfare in society. But he misinterpreted his result. What he in fact showed is that under assumptions that I think are well-constructed, reasonable for the veil of ignorance, the social contract would call for maximizing some weighted sum of the von Neumann-Morgenstern utility functions of persons. It would take me too far afield to explain why this is not equivalent to utilitarianism. There are many places you can see the argument. For instance, Chapter 4 of my 1996 book on theories of distributive justice. Recently, Juan Moreno Ternero and I have offered a way to complete Harsanyi's argument, because Harsanyi did not completely determine which weighted sum of the von Neumann-Morgenstern utility functions should be taken. The quite unattractive result after his argument is completed is that unless persons are very risk-averse, the original position can recommend distributions of welfare which are perverse in the sense of giving more wealth to talented and able people than to untalented and disabled ones. So the original position, amended a la Harsanyi and then further refined by Moreno Ternero and me, produces recommendations that any egalitarian would condemn unless persons are very risk-averse. I don't believe there's a valid argument for claiming persons actually possess the degrees of risk aversion required to avoid this perverse result. Furthermore, if the original position so constructed to filter out information about morally arbitrary events produces this outcome when individuals are not extremely risk-averse, is that result not fair, according to Rawls, in that situation? The egalitarian would seem to have to choose between fairness and equality. I've argued that Rawls inserted the issue of responsibility into his theory in only a vague and inconsistent way. He argued that persons are responsible for their life plans, but this was not reflected in his contractarian construction, where souls do not know their life plans or the life plans of the persons whom they represent. Amartya Sen offered a critique of Rawls in his 1980 lecture entitled Equality of What, but it did not focus upon this problem, but rather on Rawls's choice of the index of primary goods as the maximand for souls, rather than upon an index of what he called functionings. One way of looking at Sen's critique is to observe that he's contesting Rawls's assumption that a single set of weights is appropriate to create the index of primary goods for all persons. People have different ways of combining primary goods into functionings, Sen says, based on their physical and psychological endowments, and it is the vectors of functionings that people have or can implement that should be the concern of justice, not the vectors of primary goods. This criticism would be irrelevant if every person aggregated primary goods into functionings in the same way, and so for Sen's critique to be interesting, it must presuppose that there is no single index of primary goods which can be applied. Sen later introduced the concept of freedom and responsibility into his approach by saying that it's the set of vectors of functionings available to a person which is ethically salient, and he called this set the person's capability. Justice requires us to equalize capabilities, but the particular choice of a vector of functionings from the capability is, for Sen, the person's responsibility and is no concern of justice. This theory requires us to be able to compare sets. When is A's capability greater or better than B's? Sen never offered a solution to this problem, saying simply that in some cases we can obviously make this kind of judgment, for example, when one person's capability contains another person's. I do not believe Sen made much headway on the responsibility question, although I do think proposing his objective list theory of justice was a worthwhile contribution. In 1981, Ronald Dworkin published two articles which advanced the discussion in a major way. He posed the question, what should an egalitarian seek to equalize, and argued in the first article that equalizing welfare was an unattractive option, I'm sure you remember the argument, because of the problem of expensive tastes. That was the main argument. And in the second paper, he argued that the right thing to equalize is resource bundles, and he proposed how to do so. For Dworkin, persons have circumstances, which include their environments and their internal talents and handicaps, and they have preferences and ambitions, what Rawls would have called their life plans. Circumstances are resources and should be equalized across persons, but people are responsible for exercising their preferences. Dworkin distinguishes between brute luck and option luck. Brute luck is an event affecting the person against which he could take no precaution, against which he could not insure. Option luck is an event a person chooses to face. Thus, if my house burns down and I chose not to buy fire insurance, that's an instance of option luck. If I am hit by lightning while hiking and the weather forecast predicted fine weather and there was furthermore no lightning insurance available, that is an event of brute luck. If the weather forecast was stormy and I chose to hike, the lightning strike is option luck. Dworkin argues that brute luck is unfair, while option luck is fair precisely because a person is responsible for his choices. Perhaps the most important instance of brute luck is the birth lottery, which assigns circumstances, that is, families and genetic constitutions, to persons. No insurance was available to the individual in this case. If all resources were transferable, then equality of resources would simply mandate that an equal division of resources be effected, and then people could trade to a competitive equilibrium. This would produce a Pareto-efficient allocation in which no one envied any other person in the sense of desiring the other person's bundle. This is exactly the case of the auction on the desert island that the shipwrecked travelers face in Dworkin's second article. Unfortunately, many important resources are not transferable: families into which one is born, talents and handicaps. Dworkin's ingenious proposal is to transform the brute luck of the birth lottery, which allocates these resources, into option luck by use of a hypothetical insurance market. The venue for this market is an analog to Rawls's original position. In this venue, each person is represented by a soul. The soul knows the preferences of her person, including her preferences over risk. She does not know the circumstances of her person, but she does know the distribution of circumstances in the actual world. In Rawlsian parlance, she knows exactly those things her person is responsible for, namely preferences or life plan, and facts about the world, that is to say, the distribution of circumstances and the technology and so on. She does not know what is morally arbitrary, namely her own circumstances, or as Dworkin would say, her resource endowment. In this situation, an insurance market will operate where each soul will have the same amount of fictional money to purchase insurance. This equality among souls is key. Insurance can be purchased to pay out contingent upon the realization of various states in the birth lottery. Thus, souls can insure against their persons having bad luck in the birth lottery, and in so insuring, they use the risk preferences of their particular persons in deciding how much risk to bear. This seems to be a perfect model for Dworkin's theory, for the original position shields persons precisely of morally arbitrary facts and holds them responsible for their choices, namely the choice of how much insurance to purchase. Unfortunately, Dworkin's discussion of how this insurance market would operate is clumsy and ad hoc. He should have consulted an economist at this point, because there's a beautiful theory of insurance markets due to Kenneth Arrow, which can be applied to Dworkin's problem perfectly. Indeed, I have applied the Arrowian model of insurance to Dworkin's veil of ignorance construction, and it leads to the following result. Unless the individuals are sufficiently risk-averse, then the consequence of Dworkinian insurance will be to transfer resources from the disabled to the able, from the untalented to the talented. The intuition for this unhappy result is the following. Suppose there are two people in the world. This is a simple example. Call them Andrea and Bob. Andrea is talented or able, and Bob is handicapped. Talent, in this example, is simply the ability to convert resources, wealth, into some desired outcome, say functioning or welfare. Talent is the resource that is distributed by the brute luck of the birth lottery. The talented person transforms wealth more efficiently into welfare or functioning than does the disabled person. In the Dworkinian insurance market, there are two souls, one representing Andrea and the other representing Bob. Call them Alpha and Beta. Each knows the preferences of its person, including the person's risk preferences, but not whether its person is the talented or the disabled one. That is, the souls do not know how the birth lottery plays out. Alpha and Beta have the opportunity to take out insurance against being born disabled, i.e., as Bob. An insurance contract will take the following form. If I am born as Andrea, then I will pay X dollars to Bob. If I am born Bob, then I will receive Y dollars from Andrea. X and Y can be positive or negative. So if you say I'm going to pay out a negative number, it means you'll receive the positive amount of that number. Equilibrium in the insurance market exists when the two contracts made by Alpha and Beta match in the sense that in both states of the world, so Alpha could become Andrea and Beta Bob, or it could be the other way around. So there are two possible states of the world here. In both states of the world, demands and supplies of the transfers equal each other. Now, there are two contrasting forces at play. On the one hand, the souls wish to protect themselves against having too little wealth in the state in which they are born as Bob. On the other hand, they wish to take advantage of their superior ability to transform the resource into welfare if they happen to be born as Andrea. Which of these two forces dominates depends upon the degrees of risk aversion of Andrea and Bob, and hence of Alpha and Beta. If Andrea and Bob are insufficiently risk averse, they will write contracts, or their souls will write contracts, so that the soul born as Andrea will in fact receive the majority of the transferable wealth. This is a perverse result from the resource egalitarian viewpoint. Thus, whether the Dworkinian insurance market realizes Dworkin's aim of transferring wealth resources to those born with insufficient internal resources is entirely contingent on how risk-averse actual persons are. The insurance contracts can result in perverse outcomes if Andrea and Bob are insufficiently risk-averse. And I'll add as a comment, they can be fairly risk-averse, and this can still happen. They can be fairly risk-averse, much more risk-averse than being risk-neutral, for instance. What's wrong with the original position? Rawls's project was to produce a recommendation of equality, the difference principle, from two assumptions only, rationality and self-interest. Dworkin also believed from an assumption of self-interest, hypothetical insurance markets would suffice to allocate transferable wealth in a way to properly compensate persons for disadvantaged circumstances which were non-transferable. If egalitarians find the Gedanken experiments of the original position attractive, they are faced with a problem. Should the original position be discarded as a tool, or should equality be abandoned as a desideratum? I've puzzled over this quandary for some years. Nor am I the only one. Serge Christophe Colm and Brian Barry have both understood these issues, if not precisely in the way I have exposited them, and have come to similar conclusions. My solution is to challenge the premise of self-interest. Rawls's grand goal is unachievable, in my view. Rationality and pure self-interest will not, as far as I can see, produce equality as the social contract. One needs, in addition, an assumption of solidarity. Colm states it differently. He argues that reciprocity is what is required. Reciprocity is different from solidarity for Colm, although I won't get into the distinction here. Some kind of social glue is needed. If we posit that the social glue is embedded in the preferences of persons, then it's not difficult to construct an original position which will produce an egalitarian social contract. But once solidarity is postulated, one doesn't need the original position. One can pass directly from solidarity to equality, or to be precise, to a degree of equality which is consistent with the degree of solidarity that people have. My view is that Rawls should have skipped the whole original position construction, and Dworkin should have skipped the hypothetical insurance market, and they should have simply argued that because the assignment of families and talents to persons is morally arbitrary, compensation for the disadvantaged, by transfers from the advantaged is required. The moral arbitrariness of the distribution of these resources is the premise. Dworkin's distinction between choice and circumstance is certainly key, to some degree at least. Inequality which is due to the exercise of choice is ethically all right. How can we formulate the problem so that things work out the way we want? In 1989, G.A. Cohen and Richard Arneson each published articles critiquing Dworkin, but not along the lines I have presented. I first published my critique of the hypothetical insurance market in 1985. Both praised Dworkin for introducing responsibility into egalitarian theory. Arneson argued that Dworkin was right to move away from equality of welfare because of the expensive taste argument, but that instead of moving to equality of resources, he should have opted for what he calls equality of opportunity for welfare. He then attempted to provide a definition of what it means to equalize opportunities for welfare. Cohen argued that Dworkin had misplaced the cut between preferences and circumstances. There are certain preferences a person should not be held responsible for, even if he is glad that he has them. Think of Sen's tamed housewife and battered slave, persons who adopt insufficiently ambitious preferences because of cognitive dissonance or social pressure in order to remain sane in their poorly resourced environments. Dworkin only discounted preferences when they are addictions or cravings, preferences the person would rather not have. But many preferences are themselves induced by unjust circumstances, and we are not fully compensating persons who hold them if we hold them responsible for their choices. Cohen called for equal access to advantage, something sounding not too different from Arneson's equality of opportunity for welfare, but he never made his proposal precise. Inspired by this debate, I proposed, in 93, an approach which I view as an attempt to carry out Arneson's recommendation. I'm going to outline this approach and give several examples of its application, reply to some critiques, and issue some caveats about the scope of its application. The language of my proposal contains five words: objective, circumstances, type, effort, and policy. We suppose a planner who desires to equalize opportunities among a given population for the acquisition of some objective. Cohen would call the objective advantage, and Arneson would call it welfare, but I wish to be less grandiose and to think of it as something more observable and limited, such as life expectancy or wage earning capacity or income, something a planner might be concerned with. These objectives are things that policymakers care about. They are less encompassing and subjective than Cohen's advantage or Arneson's welfare. Individuals each have circumstances and also have the capacity to apply effort. The value of the objective, which a person will end up achieving, is a certain function, I'll call it, of circumstances, effort, and the policy that the planner chooses. I emphasize that this function, is not a utility function. Persons may be differentially interested in realizing the objective at hand, and therefore will differentially exert effort to accomplish that end. Think of you as more akin to a technology. For instance, if you is the life expectancy a person has, or the number of years the person lives, one example of low effort in this context would be smoking, because it's a voluntary activity, let's suppose, which reduces the value of that objective. My planner, however, is in this case the Minister of Health, and she is interested in equalizing opportunities for life expectancy in her society, so she wishes to get high effort out of people, that is to say, to reduce their smoking, even if some people like to smoke. For the sake of practicality, I partition the set of circumstances into a finite number of elements, which I call types. A type is the set of people with similar circumstances. Circumstances, as for Dworkin, are taken to be the aspects of persons' environments which are beyond their control and which influence their ability to acquire the objective. Continuing the life expectancy example, we could define effort as an index of the choices that people make which influence their life expectancy, an index including whether or not they smoke, what their eating and exercise habits are, and so on. We can construct this index by observing the relationship of these behaviors and circumstances to age of death in the population. This will give us the function U, the technology. Now, the set of policies is a set of interventions available to the health ministry, health insurance, spending on education about the links between effort and mortality, income transfers, and so on. For any policy that is chosen, there will result a specific distribution of effort in each type. It is important to note that these distributions of effort may be very different across types. For instance, if we take socioeconomic status as a circumstance, it may be the case that the distribution of effort is much worse in poor types than in rich types. In particular, the distribution of effort is itself a circumstance. It's beyond the control of the individual, and it is a reflection of the other circumstances that people have. The distribution is a circumstance, the distribution of effort. Equality of opportunity is achieved, I say, when the degree of acquisition of the objective is independent of a person's circumstance, but responsive to his degree of effort. This is the interpretation of Dworkin's idea. People should be indemnified against the effects of their circumstances, but held responsible for their degree of effort. The tricky part is that the distribution of effort is, as I said, itself a function of circumstances. So how can we implement the Dworkinian idea? When do we decide one person has expended more effort than another? We can easily compare the efforts of people within the same type, because these people have the same circumstances and they face the same policy, so simply observe which one has the higher index of choices we call effort. But how can we compare the efforts of two people in different types? We require a measure of the degree of effort which sterilizes the index of effort of the effect of circumstances upon it. Such an index, I say, is the rank of the person in the effort distribution of his type. Thus, I declare two people of different types to have expended the same degree of effort if they lie at the same centile of the effort distributions of their types. Now, by definition, effort is defined as that constellation of choices which, if increased, will increase the value of the objective within any type. Higher effort leads to a better value of the objective. It follows that the individual at the pth centile of the effort distribution of his type will also be the person at the pth centile of the distribution of the objective in his type, since circumstances and policy are fixed for the type. Therefore, equality of opportunity for the objective is achieved precisely when the distributions of the objective are identical across types. For this is the result if we equalize the objectives at every centile of their distributions across types. So the planner desires to choose the policy which equalizes the distributions of the objective across types. To summarize, the equality part of equal opportunity is that regardless of one's circumstances, one will face the same distribution of the objective. That is, one will have the same probability of achieving given levels of the acquisition of the objective, regardless of type. The opportunity part is that we do not seek to equalize the value of the objective across all persons, but only to equalize the distributions, as I said. Greater effort will bring about a greater degree of acquisition of the objective within type. Thus, a person is not responsible for his circumstances, but is responsible for how well off he will be by choosing his effort, and hence his place on the distribution of the objective. Here's a graphic example. I finally come to the board. In the example, the outcome for which opportunities are to be equalized is wage-earning capacity. The single circumstance, this is actually from real data, the single circumstance is the level of education of the mother of the worker. And in the figure, I plot the distribution of earnings for three types of male workers in the U.S., all young men in their 30s, three types of male workers, those whose mothers did not graduate from high school, those whose mothers had exactly 12 years of education, and those whose mothers had at least some tertiary education. So the unique circumstance is the education of your mother. We see the cumulative distribution functions, which is what these are, for these three types of workers do not cross. Your chances of earning more are unambiguously greater the more education your mother had. The difference between the distribution functions is due to unequal opportunity. The difference along each distribution function is interpreted as due to differential effort. The goal of an equal opportunity policy is to push these three distribution functions closer together. In the next figure, I plot the same three distribution functions in the same year for the same age of male workers for Denmark. It appears that opportunities for wage earning capacity are much more equal in Denmark than in the United States. The distribution functions are very close together. In practice, it's almost always impossible to find a policy. I mean, for those of you who are not statistically inclined, I'll show you how to read this. If you, say, take $40,000 annual earnings on the horizontal axis, and you look at the blue curve, that's the curve associated with the most advantaged group, it says approximately 40% of people of that type will earn less than $40,000. But if you look at the value on the red curve, it says about 75% of people of the red type will earn less than $40,000. The red type are the workers whose mothers did not finish high school. So there's a substantial premium to being born to a mother who's had some tertiary education. In practice, it's almost always impossible to find a policy that will equalize perfectly the distributions of the objective across types. One must, therefore, adopt some second-best approach. A number of such approaches have been proposed. The simplest one is to choose that policy that maximizes the minimum of the mean value of the objective across types. This sounds very much like Rawls's difference principle, except here it's applied only to the aggregates called types rather than to individuals. There are other second best measures that I won't proceed to discuss here. Now I'm going to present two applications of this approach. The first takes the population to be American males, the objective to be wage earning capacity, circumstances to be characteristic of the individual's family background, in particular the education of the parents, and in the computation I describe, which I did with a labor economist named Julian Betts, we chose actually the education of the mother to be the single characteristic of type, more or less like as in the pictures I've shown you here, and we partitioned the population of young men into four types. Mother had less than 8 years of education, mother had between 8 and 12 years, mother had exactly 12 years, and mother had more than 12 years. And these mothers were educated in the 1950s or the late 40s. So there were a substantial number whose mothers were very poorly educated, namely black mothers. The policies are educational finance policies of the form X1, X2, X3, X4, where we take a given budget for education and we decide how much of it to assign to the education of each type. We just presume we can spend different amounts on different types. So X2 is the amount per annum that we spend per capita on children of type 2. In the U.S., because we have local financing of K-12 education, there is much variation in per pupil spending across the country. And so there are data sets which allow us to estimate how adult wages vary as a function of per-pupil expenditure and type. Using these data sets, we compute the required relationships, that is to say, the function U, which tells us what the achievement will be, as a function of the circumstances of the person and the policy, which is the spending on his education. And we look for the vector of expenditures, X1, X2, X3, X4, that makes the distribution of wages across the four types as close as possible to being equal. The result is presented in the next picture, next table. The young men in the sample were in secondary school in the late 60s, and we took the annual per pupil expenditure to be $2,500 per annum, which was the U.S. national average expenditure at that time. The equal opportunity allocation is that we spend $5,300 and some dollars on each child from the most disadvantaged family, and only $1,100 on each child from the most advantaged family. In other words, we spend about five times as much on the most disadvantaged children. Note that this allocation is very different from the equal resource allocation, which would spend $2,500 on every pupil. Indeed, even achieving that equal resource allocation would have been a considerable improvement over the existing U.S. allocation in 1970, where richer municipalities spend more on their pupils than poor ones. The equal opportunity allocation is highly skewed towards the disadvantaged. Moreover, we predict that if educational resources had been allocated in this manner, then the average wage would have risen by 2.6% compared with what it in fact was. That's the last number in this table. Thus, equalizing opportunities in this case increases total output. This happy result will not always occur with equal opportunity policies. And you see that the wages are almost equalized across the four types. The predicted average wages of the four types are almost equalized at this allocation of educational spending, much more equal than they are in actuality. These are weekly wages. My second example is hypothetical. There's no data in it. Suppose there's a society with two types, poor and rich. 25% of the population is poor, and 75% is rich. There are two diseases, tuberculosis and cancer. Both types, rich and poor, are susceptible to cancer, but only the poor will contract TB. The probability of contracting cancer is the same for the rich and poor as a function of the quality of lifestyle which they lead, which I call Q. And the supposition is, I'm going to give you actual functional forms, or else the result wouldn't mean much to you. The probability of getting cancer as a function of how good your lifestyle is, whether you're rich or poor, is 1 minus 2q over 3. So the important thing to notice, q is going to be a single number. We're going to measure lifestyle quality by a number. The only important thing to notice is as your lifestyle quality goes up, your probability of contracting cancer decreases. Now, a poor person's probability of contracting TB as a function of lifestyle quality is given by 1 minus Q over 3. And as I said, the rich don't get TB at all. The life expectancy of a rich person is 70 if cancer is not contracted. And the following formula, if cancer is contracted, where X sub C is the amount spent on the treatment of the cancer. So the important thing to notice here is if XC is 0, then that fraction becomes negative 1, and hence the life expectancy of the person will be 50, 60 minus 10. But if XC is very large, like 1,000, then that ratio, XC minus 1 over XC plus 1, is almost 1, and so the life expectancy gets very close to 70. So the life expectancy will vary between 50 and 70, depending on how much we decide to allocate to the treatment of cancer. Suppose the life expectancy of a poor person is 70 if neither disease is contracted, the same formula as the rich have if cancer is contracted, and then another formula as a function of the amount spent on TB if TB is contracted. Thus, a poor will have a life expectancy of only 30 if TB is contracted and not treated at all. but their life expectancy will approach 70 if it's contracted, and a lot is spent on its treatment. But notice that TB is less responsive to treatment than cancer, because there's a 0.1 times X sub TB, but a 1 on the X sub cancer. That means you have to pour money, more money into TB treatment to have an effect on life expectancy. Now, suppose that the poor have lifestyles, Q, which are uniformly distributed on the interval 0, 1, while the rich have lifestyle qualities that are uniformly distributed on the interval 1/2 to 1.5. So the rich have healthier lifestyles on average. Suppose a policy is a vector of expenditures, XC, XT, which prescribes how much will be spent on each case of cancer and each case of TB. So that's what the Minister of Health has to decide, how to allocate the money between cancer and TB treatment. Note these expenditures are, by hypothesis, independent of the type of the person. Treatment is horizontally equitable by postulate in the sense that each case is treated in the same way, regardless of the type of person and regardless of the lifestyle of that person. Of course, given the knowledge of the frequencies of the disease in the population as a function of lifestyles and the knowledge of the distribution of lifestyles, the ministry can compute the set of feasible policies. The problem then is to choose the policy which will maximize the minimum life expectancy across the two types. It turns out the solution is, given on this slide, the optimal policy is to spend $250 on each cancer case and $13,900 on each TB case. Don't hold me responsible for the numbers. I've just made up the example, right? I could make it more reasonable if we wanted to. Much more is spent on a case of TB than on a case of cancer. Now, the objective here was what? Maximizing the minimum life expectancy across the types. That was the interpretation of equalizing their opportunities for life expectancy. Now, the life expectancies for these two types are shown at this optimal policy are shown in this figure. So the horizontal axis is the centile on the effort distribution that the person sits at, and the vertical axis is life expectancy. The higher line is the life expectancy of the rich. So the rich have higher life expectancy than the poor at every degree of lifestyle quality. Why does the life expectancy of the poor remain considerably below that of the rich? Because we don't discriminate between the poor and the rich in treatment. There is no other feasible policy which would raise the average life expectancy of the poor above what it is here, given that we maintain horizontal equity. If we wished to discriminate between the poor and the rich in cancer treatment, we could raise the life expectancy of the poor considerably higher at the cost of reducing the life expectancy of the rich. But I've chosen the set of policies to disallow this kind of discrimination. Let me contrast the equal opportunity policy with the utilitarian policy, which is the policy from the same feasible set that maximizes the average life expectancy for the entire population. This policy turns out to be $2,520 on every cancer case, about 10 times as much as before, and $9,300 on every case of TB. We now spend much more on cancer than before, and correspondingly less on TB. Notice that the life expectancies of the two types, which are given by the thin lines on the graph, are much farther apart under the utilitarian policy. We have a higher average life expectancy in the population at the cost of greater inequality of life expectancy across types. Virtually all health ministries today, I believe, were they to face this kind of problem, would choose the utilitarian policy, because that is the dominant ideology in health economics, as in economics quite generally, and we know the ministers of health would consult economists. Let me summarize a number of features of these two examples. First, effort is treated as a residual explanandum of the objective once circumstances are delineated. If we wish to predict the distribution of the objective within each type, we will require a theory of how the policy chosen will influence the distributions of effort and hence the distributions of the objective. Two, the policy itself can be type blind and effort blind, as it is in the health example. This is a matter of how the policy space is delineated. We can make the policy applied depend on the individual's type, but we need not. Similarly, we can make the policy applied depend upon the individual's effort, but we need not. In both cases that I've given, the policy did not depend upon individual effort. In the education example, it does depend upon the individual's type. So the policy doesn't have to depend on effort, even though the outcome will depend on effort. Three, equality of opportunity attempts to equalize the objective across types, while utilitarianism attempts to maximize the average of the objective in the aggregate. Thus, EOP policies will deliver lower average accomplishment than utilitarian ones, and utilitarian policies will be less equal across types than equal opportunity ones. This is by definition of what it means to maximize each of the two social objectives. Point four, one can design equal opportunity policy to be consonant with the society's views concerning responsibility by choosing the set of circumstances to reflect those views. The more characteristics of the person's environment we include in this set, the less will performance be attributed to effort. In the limit, if we choose each individual to comprise a single type by herself, then there is no scope for effort, and the equal opportunity policy converges to the Rawlsian maximum across all persons. At the other extreme, if we choose all persons to be of a single type, then the policy is simply utilitarian. Maximize the average value of the objective, tout court. In general, the EOP policy is less distributive than complete maximin and more redistributive than utilitarianism. Now to some critiques and caveats. Some writers have argued that to implement the equal opportunity policy requires an invasion of privacy in order to ascertain the effort that individuals have expended. For instance, Elizabeth Anderson says this. One envisions grilling a lung cancer victim about his smoking behavior before deciding on how to treat him. The examples show this is false. In neither example is it necessary to ascertain the effort of individuals before applying the policy. Indeed, in the health example, it's not even necessary to ascertain their type. The planning ministry does need to know the effort response to policies by type in the society, but this can be ascertained with studies on small representative samples of the population. Formally, it is only the distributions of effort and objective with which the planner is concerned, not individual responses. Two, some critics say that effort, in the sense of actions for which individuals should be held responsible, is a useless concept when it comes to something so vital as health or even education. These critics say that the relevant actions in these spheres are socially determined, not voluntary. My response is that they are both socially determined and voluntary. When the price of tobacco is sufficiently high, fewer people smoke. Thus, smoking is, to some degree at least, an act of choice. More educated people typically smoke less than less educated people. So smoking is, to some degree at least, socially determined. In any case, the equal opportunity theory is agnostic about the true role of voluntary effort versus circumstances in determining behavior. Rather than solving that metaphysical problem, it provides a policy which is consonant with any particular view one might delineate concerning responsibility and circumstance. Some critics focus upon the inequality within types that results from the application of the equal opportunity policy, but one may just as well focus upon the equality across types which it implements. Indeed, the EOP educational policies I presented are radically more egalitarian than the finance policies of any actual country in terms of compensation for social disadvantage. Now to some caveats. What is the scope of equal opportunity policy? should the Ministry of Sports require professional basketball teams to admit a certain number of very high-effort short players? That is, should height be considered a circumstance in this case? Obviously, the answer is no. Equal opportunity, I say obviously, maybe you don't agree. Equal opportunity policy considers only the welfare of people who are competing for some kind of advantage in a world of scarce resources. The examples I have given do not take into account the effect of this policy on the general welfare of the entire population. In the case of professional basketball, there is a very small number of players and millions of fans. The welfare of the fans should count more than the welfare of the players. Assuming short players on a team would lead to an inferior game, the fans' welfare trumps equalizing opportunities for players. Consider a more serious example. Should we admit some socially disadvantaged but high-effort surgeons who are actually inferior in skill to socially advantaged high-effort surgeons to the surgery profession? Fairness among surgeons would perhaps say yes. Consideration of the welfare of patients would say no. Richard Arneson's response to this problem is to say that it's a mistake to apply equal opportunity policy in discrete spheres, such as to the question of who should be chosen to be surgeons. Rather, one should aim to equalize opportunities for welfare over the entire population. Thus, we would, for example, limit the extent to which we license high-effort surgeons from disadvantaged backgrounds, because doing so would reduce the opportunities for welfare of patients. I have no objection to Arneson's proposal, except that it's unworkable. Practicality requires the discrete sphere approach. And so we must be content to deal with the kind of, there is no ministry for overall welfare of the population, but there is a health ministry and an education ministry. Practicality requires the discrete sphere approach, and so we must be content to deal with the conflict I have described in a somewhat ad hoc way. I would propose a general rule of thumb. When we're considering individuals who are being trained or educated, I would tend to favor applying equal opportunity principles. When we consider people competing for professions or occupations in society, I would stress merit. Thus, I would have an equal opportunity admissions process for medical schools, but I would apply strict merit principles in licensing surgeons. I would admit a certain number of short basketball players to high school teams, which have an educational function, but I would consider only basketball prowess for recruitment to professional teams. I believe this rule of thumb has general support in the United States. In the debate over affirmative action admissions to universities, many objected to counting race as a circumstance, who do not object to counting socioeconomic characteristics as circumstances. Thus, the universities of California and Texas, both public institutions, some years ago replaced racial preferences with preferences for socioeconomic disadvantage. Of course, African Americans and Hispanics count highly in the economically most disadvantaged type. Citizens in this case did not object to an equal opportunity policy, but they objected to counting race as a circumstance because it sometimes did not correlate well with economic disadvantage. But with respect to hiring, citizens objected to any kind of affirmative action. Here they expressed the opinion that hiring should be strictly meritocratic. This is the cut between education and training on the one hand and competition for occupations on the other that I have suggested. Due to time, I'll skip the next section, which discusses the degree of inequality of opportunity in actual societies, how much of the inequality is due to circumstances, and I will simply conclude. We do find that in developing countries, I'll just give you this fact about the extent. We do find in developing countries, there's interesting work by Francisco Ferreira in the World Bank and some of his colleagues, that using a relatively small number of circumstances, four or five circumstances, parental income, parental education, region of the country in which you live, ethnicity, basically those circumstances, that between 30 and 50% of income inequality in Latin American countries is due to circumstances, which is a lower bound on the true amount because of the limited number of circumstances that they used. I would propose in conclusion that a good measure of economic development is the degree to which earnings inequality is due to effort and not to circumstances. In Sweden, preliminary work that I've done with with the Finnish and Swedish economists shows that over 75% of the inequality is due to effort. And this is when we choose many, many circumstances, parental income type, parental educational type, IQ of the individual, which if it's is at the at a young age, it's a consequence of both nurture and nature, both of which are circumstances, sibling type, that is to say, how many children in the family, family type, single parent, two parents, and body mass index, which is both circumstances, which is large, which is a, I mean, that's a question as to whether that's effort or circumstances. But we chose those circumstances, we explain only 25% of the inequality. So in Sweden, there's substantially less inequality due to circumstances than in the developing countries of Latin America. So I propose that a good measure of economic development is the degree to which earnings inequality is due to effort and not to circumstances. A country would count as developed to the extent that it had eliminated the effect of morally arbitrary factors on earnings. In other words, economic development means approaching distributive justice in the sense that contemporary egalitarian theory has defined it. Thank you.